confronted by a drunken, necessarily, I wouldn't say hooligan, but drunken and disorderly fans.
Criticism of the World Cup's first ever Arab host, Qatar, was always expected, but few would have predicted the outpouring of anti-Islam sentiment that accompanied it. Qatari authorities have made efforts to showcase Islam during the event also. Quran recitations, pauses for prayer, and inviting famous Dawah activists. But does the Dawah effort make up for the permitting of haram practices?
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk more about Islam and the Qatar-hosted World Cup is Sheikh Tawqir Ishaq, an international lecturer in Islamic sciences, currently the head of halal certification for the Halal Regulatory Commission, and Roja Mohammed Saleh, a journalist with a specialism in Islamic affairs. He's also the editor-in-chief of Muslim news website Five Pillars. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, of course. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Sheikh, let me come straight to you for your expertise on this. I'm very interested to hear what your opinion is on Qatar. Straight up, do you think Qatar has compromised on Islamic values here?
Of course Qatar has compromised Islamic values, but that's not to be unexpected. Why are we so surprised about that? Just because you're a Muslim majority country doesn't mean you're an Islamic country. You've got a half a dozen countries run by monarchies. They will interpret Islam how they like. They will implement the laws they like. We shouldn't be so surprised. We shouldn't have expectations from them. If you're going to host something like this, you can't host it without compromising Islam, unfortunately. The fans want alcohol. They want to experience that drunken state when they're enjoying themselves. They want to have rowdy behavior. That's what it's all about. If you look at the way they entertain themselves, it's part of the culture of a non-Muslim. And if you're going to try and mix that with Dawah, that's fine, good luck with that. But of course they've had to compromise, and they are compromising.
I think, obviously, yes, there is that side of the argument. But at the same time, it also seems like the Qatari authorities have benefited quite a lot from a PR perspective, even from some elements of the Muslim community who have seen things like, okay, there is alcohol sales available, but the ban on alcohol sales in the stadium last minute was kind of seen as like a step in the right direction, and there's a bit of dour activity going on, it seems, during this competition. What's your response to that?
Of course there are positives to this, and I'm glad there is dawah going on, but you can't have dawah over a pint of beer, okay? You've got to have dawah on your conditions and within your boundaries. And to be honest, spending $300 billion on a 30-day event, which is $10 billion a day. I think there's a lot better ways you can spend that money on dawah, on welfare, on charity, etc. You didn't need to do all this and buy the World Cup. As I said, you've got, unfortunately, a bunch of monarchies. I suppose they want to adopt the Western mindset, and they want to show themselves how involved and integrated they are. I'm sorry, the two systems can't mix. But they're not Islamic countries. They've never been Islamic countries. And we have to. We shouldn't be so surprised. What did we expect from these countries? Do we expect leadership, Islamic leadership? That's not going to happen. Did we expect representation? That's not going to happen. They're not going to defend. They haven't defended Islam on the world stage. Do we expect Islamic guidance from them? How are you going? We're not going to expect any of this. So why are we so surprised that this is going on? They're already, mentally speaking, they've adopted the un-Islamic mindset of Western culture. They should adopt the Islamic mindset of Islamic culture. Then they'll be far more successful and far more respected in the world.
Roshan, I'm going to come and bring you in on this from a different angle, because, regardless of what the criticism on Qatar has been, one aspect of the criticism from the Western world, from the European side, is less to do with the fact that, they're compromising on Islam. It's more to do with the fact that, they are considered a Muslim-majority country, mm-hmm. and that there are elements of the religion present in this competition. What do you make of the Western condemnation?
It's been hypocritical, because obviously there was no such focus on, Western states, which have committed far worse human rights abuses than Qatar ever has. I mean, Qatar hasn't invaded anybody in the last 20 years. And, we've got international sporting tournaments being held in Western countries, the UK, France, the US, which have literally invaded and occupied and destroyed countries in recent history, but there's no such focus on them. So it's highly hypocritical. And I really find these footballers that are doing these protests and, you know, they're very ignorant about the issues anyway. But, you know, they've never done these protests when the Euros was held, you know, in the UK last year, World Cup in France 98, USA 94. So I find it highly hypocritical. And ultimately, even enemies of the West, such as China and Russia, there was criticism of the Olympics being held in China and Russia, the World Cup, there was, but not to this level of vitriol. And we have to remember that, you know, Qatar is a key Western ally. So there's something underlying this campaign. And for me, it's obvious. It's Islamophobia. They don't like the fact that this is a Muslim country hosting an international sporting tournament of this stature.
That is interesting that you bring that up, because there's like two sides here. There's is Qatar compromising on Islamic values, but then there is clearly some kind of Islamophobic campaign being pushed from the Western side as well. So it's like they're kind of playing on both sides a little bit. Sheikh, I want to come in and ask you a question which, you know, I wouldn't be able to answer. It's a question on Islam's view of the LGBT issue. That's something which has been very prominent in the debates and the criticism of Qatar. But like, alcohol's easy. It shouldn't be there. Simple as. LGBT, Qatar has laws against it, but fans of that lifestyle are going to go. How should it be policed? Should they be allowed to go even? Let me pass that question to you.
I don't think anybody should be forbidden going to the country because of their beliefs. So that's part of dawah, that's part of welcoming people. I do support Qatar on this, especially against the victimisation they've experienced by the Western press and the politicians that have been attacking them. That's completely unfair and completely hypocritical. Of course, everybody should be allowed to come. Dawah is part of our religion, is part of our deen. So you can't stop someone, you can't ask them questions as to what their political personal beliefs are. So that's not an issue. Even someone who drinks, you don't stop them coming to a Muslim country. Some Muslims drink because they're sinful, so that doesn't mean you stop them coming to a Muslim country. So that's not an issue. The issue is they've been victimized on these laws. Most of the world is against LGBT. Russia has laws against this. It's not a unique thing to Qatar. All the Gulf countries are against this. This is just an issue that the Western nations have decided to adopt to try and bash Islam, to try and show Islam to be backwards and evil and etc., to demonize the Muslims. Now, in all the major religions, this type of belief and practice is actually anti-God. It's actually against divine rules, against belief systems. It's not just Islam. If priests and rabbis, forgive me, but if some of them want to compromise their scripture or their belief systems, that's up to them. But in Islam, it's very clear. You have the people of Lut, the Qawmi Lut, people of Lot, Prophet Lot, who are destroyed because of their practices in terms of LGBT. It's nothing new here. This is a very old belief system, and it's a system that is against God's laws.
This is why I'm glad that you're on the show today to address these issues, because, again, Qatar's being portrayed by some in the West as a dangerous country. And okay, they have laws against certain worldviews, like on this issue, which the West may not get or agree with. But to say that Qatar is dangerous, or the Islamic world is dangerous for someone like that to visit, at least, that's not true, is it?
It's not true at all. People have felt very welcome when they've gone there. I think people have interviewed fans, etc. They feel very welcome. Although the only complaint they've got is how much they're having to pay for accommodation and for a pint of beer. They're having to pay for quite a lot. I don't know the details. And many of them have actually chosen to live outside Qatar because it's a very small peninsula, so it's very easy to travel actually in and out for matches. But everybody's feeling welcome. They've done their best to make everybody feel welcome. Now, in that sense, that's an Islamic thing to do. That's a Muslim thing to do. But if you look at the background, the intention, I don't think, was for dawah for this. The intention was to just show off their credentials and just try and be loved by the world, which is fine. But I'm sure they could have done it in a slightly different way. I can do a lot with $10 billion, okay? I can build
more than that.
A number of hospitals for $10 billion. $10 billion a day. And that's how much they're spending for dawah. I'm sorry, I don't see that's realistic. I don't see that was their intention.
OK, before we continue our discussion on the World Cup, let's have a look at some other Islamic stories that have been trending this month. Reports from the US suggest that more than ever, Muslim American parents are seeking a spot in Islamic schools for their children, although the data is lacking on the exact number of Islamic schools across the states. Issues including same-sex marriage and a haram environment have been quoted as reasons behind the growing trend. And a British school has become embroiled in an Islamophobia scandal after Muslim students challenged a visit by a self-described gay Muslim. Following a heated exchange between Wood Green Academy teachers and students, a number of Muslim parents have stopped sending their children to the school. Local religious leadership have weighed into the dispute and are preparing a legal challenge if needed. Coming back to Qatar now, one viewpoint which hasn't been platformed so much is internal Muslim community concerns that Qatar's authorities have compromised on some key Islamic faith and Arab cultural values in order to cater for Western guests. We put this question to Qatari commentator Sister Sheikha Al Murray, who provided her take on the issue.
As a Muslim woman, I know that my Islamic religion and teachings is tolerant to other peoples, and we have this verse that says no compulsion in religion. This is the major thing when it comes to religion. So there's no compulsion. There's no enforcement when it comes to people believing in specific stuff. So how about practices? We are human beings. We are not, free of mistakes, of limits. We are very limited to ourselves and our abilities. We are, we have the ability to do mistakes. Thus, our culture, our Islamic culture background reinforce, tolerance when it comes to people of different practices, of different beliefs. Not that we agree with them, but we give them limits when it comes to promoting such practices that affects, public. And this is data that is, recognized by the psychological aspect when it comes to promoting such practices and in influencing, the public. So when we allow such practices, it doesn't mean that we agree with it, but it's a matter of tolerance, and we are in life debate, and we are kind of in a journey of, kind of influencing and learning from others. So who knows, maybe people who, drink alcohol, maybe they will be, when they are in the Muslim communities, the discussions will be inevitable when it comes to their own practices, their own beliefs, how it's reflected and how does it affect to their mental well-being and to their, overall well-being. So these kind of critical, debates, critical discussions when it comes to life quality, I think those people who drinks living in such a Islamic community, they will get to know more when it comes to practices in daily life and how that impacts to their own well-being and the community as a whole. So we see life as a journey of learning, and giving them a limited space of specific practices as part of the learning journey and life that we as a Muslim believe in.
Well, we're going to head back to the discussion now on Qatar and the World Cup with my guests, Sheikh Tawkir Ishak and journalist Roshan Mohammed Saleh. Now, I'm going to come back to you, Sheikh, on this, because you've heard a reaction which is a very typical Qatari response to the criticism, particularly on this issue of Muslim concerns about them upholding Islamic values and so on. Now, ultimately, I think the message that Sheikh was trying to make was that, look, at the end of the day, this isn't a chance. This is a chance for Qatar, for the Arabic culture, for Islam to be seen by millions of people around the world, inside the non-Muslim community as well. And ultimately, yeah, some compromises are made, but we've seen reports coming out of people embracing Islam whilst out there watching the World Cup as well. So do you think that there is any justification that the bigger picture is that, yes, there are benefits to this. Would you concede that point?
As I said, of course there are benefits if you're going to do dawah. But people are going there not for dawah, they're going there to watch football matches. That's their primary reason and that's their primary concern. If they see a little bit of Islam, you can see that anyway if you want to. They're not going to experience Qatari culture because they're living in a very sort of sterilized areas where they have their drinking and they have their matches and they have their hotels. So the dawah isn't being imposed on them and it shouldn't be. So they've gone there primarily for football, okay? If people convert, they'll convert anyway if they go to Qatar, to be very honest with you. But we are not in the business of promoting haram. Otherwise, you could argue, let's start selling idols to idol worshippers. Let's start manufacturing alcohol and say, this is a gift from us as your Muslim neighbor. We're not allowed to do things like that. We're not even allowed to carry alcohol. The Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, just forbade it. And the Quran calls it ithmun kabir. This is a very serious, a very great sin, alcohol and gambling. And both of these are associated with football. You can't separate that mentality from the fan culture. So, yeah, as I said, there are positives, but you do things in a good way and the right way, not in the wrong way.
And what about the sister's point about there being no compulsion in Islam? What's your response to that?
No, she's right. La ikraha fi din, there's no compulsion in Islam, but this is not what this is about. We're promoting a haram culture. I don't agree with that. We should do dawah in a halal way, but we don't need these events as an excuse or a reason to do dawah. Dawah can be done in a much, much better way. Look, Qatar does a lot of charity work. They do very good charity work for the Palestinians, for Syria, for Muslims in need. This is where the money should have gone. 300 billion is not a small amount. You can end world poverty for a number of years. And that would have been better for Qatar in terms of their publicity, better for dawah, better for all these aspects. As I said, we need to adopt the Islamic mindset, not the Western mindset.
And Roshan, I'm going to bring you in on a point which we discussed briefly earlier. It's about the money involved in the competition. Mm. Now, obviously, a lot has been spent. Some could argue that money could have been spent on better causes, particularly in the Muslim world. There's a lot of poverty and so on, warfare going on. What do you think of that?
I think it should have been. And ultimately, I do think there are legitimate reasons to criticise Qatar. I mean, I used to live in Qatar for a few years, so I know the country very well. And there are problems with migrant workers. And one good thing about this World Cup is that the focus has been on migrant workers and their conditions have improved a little bit. So we can't deny that.
The numbers on that are disputed, though,
Roshan.
Heavily disputed. I think a lot of the heavy figures coming from Europe on this might be exaggerated, I'm
yeah,
not sure.
Yeah, they said there were 6,500 deaths, which
hard
I think is true.
Hard to confirm, but it is worth mentioning the Qatari authorities definitely believe those numbers are inflated drastically.
Yes,
so.
And just briefly, a couple of other reasons, genuine reasons to focus on Qatar is, well, what no one talks about is that they have a massive US military airbase there, which was used to launch wars on Iraq and Afghanistan, which is generally used to kind of threaten, intimidate, spy on the Muslim world. That, for me, is their greatest sin, and no one talks about that. And Qatar is also quite a racist society. You have this social hierarchy with the Qataris at the top and then the white Westerners, and then right at the bottom you have the South Asian migrant workers, and whether they're Muslim or not, they're still discriminated against. So there are legitimate reasons to talk about Qatar, and I don't mind people talking about that, but what we've had instead is this focus on LGBT rights and, you know, kind of Western concerns. And because the West kind of has the most powerful voice in world media, even though it's a minority of the world population, you know, we're hearing more about those things rather than, you know, legitimate criticisms of Qatar like the US airbase.
And what about the fact that, you know, like, I hear what your argument is, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and a lot of people agree with you, but I just can't see a scenario where the entire Muslim world just never engages with the non-Islamic world on competitions like this. Do you not see any benefit at all for Qatar?
No, I am of the position that Muslim countries should not host international sporting tournaments like the Olympics and the World Cup simply because the Islamic price they pay is too high. You know, I mean, the Qatari law has literally been changed this month. They've changed their laws on alcohol, on LGBT, on other stuff as well. They're allowing Israelis into the country. Qatar has no diplomatic relations with Israel, but for this month, Israelis can come in and out of the country freely. So the price they're paying Islamically from a religious aspect and also from a political aspect is far too high. Yes, of course we should engage with non-Muslims, but we have to engage on our terms and without compromising Islam. And I say we cannot compromise one inch on our deen and our religion. And unfortunately, Qatar has done that.
Sheikh, I'm going to put a scenario to you. Imagine the Qatari authorities, ahead of this World Cup, they reach out to you and they say, we want to do it right. We're going to do it, but we want to do it acceptable for the Muslim world, according to Islamic values, so on and so forth. How would you handle a situation like this?
You can't do it right because they wouldn't allow it if you're going to ban alcohol and you're going to ban, you're not going to change your laws. You can't do it right. So I agree with Brother Roshan. If you want to hold these events, you're going to have to compromise your belief system and then make excuses to yourself why it's a good thing to do. And that's that compromise is not acceptable. Allah says in the Holy Quran that the Jews and Christians will never be happy with you until you believe what they believe. They will like many aspects of your religion. They will like your honesty. They will like your hygiene. They will like your hospitality. They will not like your kalima. They will not like your kalima tayyiba, la ilaha illallah. And this is exactly what happened when the Prophet came, announced himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, to the Meccans. They said, look, you can carry on, but just stop saying this. We'll give you everything you need. And he didn't sell his religion. And this is what we're doing. We're selling ourselves, we're selling our religion. And we have nothing to apologize for. We have nothing to feel second-class citizens for. Our morality, our way of life is directly from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we should be proud of it, and we should easily be able to defend it because it is haqq. Al-haqqum min rabbik, this is the truth from your Lord. And unfortunately, these governments and these institutions, they're letting down Islam and they're letting down the Muslim world.
Roshan, very quickly, a few seconds left. The Qatari authorities have policed some things, especially non-Muslim fans coming in with like crusader outfits and trying to bring alcohol in stadiums. Have you enjoyed watching that to a degree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Qataris have stood up for a few things. Stadium bans on alcohol and, you know, kicking out the crusaders, as you say. But ultimately, you have to weigh the positives and the negatives. And for me, the negatives far outweigh the positives in terms of hosting this World Cup in an Islamic nation.
OK, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you to our guest. And for everyone at home, we hope you enjoyed what's going to be the first of hopefully many episodes of Eye on Islam, inshallah. Eye on Islam is a show which will not blindly follow the dominating news agendas. We won't be regurgitating generic geopolitical views or cliche stereotypes here, but on all of our programs, you'll get informative views about the beautiful religion of Islam in a brave and unapologetic style. Here, we are proud Muslims and love the faith. And at a time when Muslims live in constant fear amid widespread Islamophobia, we hope to relentlessly promote traditional Islam, resisting fitna or modern reinterpretations, and keep the community engaged, informed, and also entertained too. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, salamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., a top federal judge has denied a request from the Justice Department to hold Donald Trump's office in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena demanding the return of all documents bearing classified markings. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. ABC News has covered this story. A federal judge in Washington declined to hold former President Donald Trump or his legal team in contempt of court following a court hearing on Friday, 9th of December, as the Justice Department had requested, sources familiar with the matter have told ABC News. The judge instead urged the Justice Department and Donald Trump's legal team to resolve the dispute themselves, the source said. The Department of Justice had urged the judge to hold Trump's team in contempt over their failure to fully comply with a May subpoena for documents with classified markings that was directed to Donald Trump's custodian of records, a person the Trump legal team has not identified. The proceedings were under seal and not public. The president and his counsel will continue to be transparent and cooperative even in the face of the highly weaponized and corrupt witch hunt from the Department of Justice, Donald Trump's spokesperson Stephen Chung said in a statement. If the Department of Justice can go after President Trump, they will surely come after any American who they disagree with, Chung said. President Trump is the only one who stands in the way of the un-American weaponization of law enforcement. The Department of Justice has declined to comment. The Department of Justice's urging was part of the court proceeding in Washington, in which the DOJ and Donald Trump's lawyers have battled for weeks over compliance with grand jury subpoenas, sources have told ABC News. The Trump team has also not wanted to identify an official custodian of records to attend, that all records have been handed over. Fox News has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. A federal judge has declined to take action to hold former President Donald Trump in contempt of court during a closed-door hearing on Friday, 9th of December, according to two sources with knowledge of the proceedings. Friday's hearing was in relation to a federal probe into Donald Trump's handling of classified material at his Florida estate at Mar-a-Lago. Judge Beryl Howell urged lawyers from the Department of Justice and Donald Trump's team to work out the matter on their own during a 90-minute meeting in a Washington, D.C. federal court. The Justice Department has become increasingly frustrated with lawyers for Donald Trump over the past few months for allegedly failing to comply with a subpoena asking for classified documents in Trump's possession to be returned, sources have told Fox News. Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate was the subject of a search warrant executed back in August by Federal Bureau of Investigation agents, FBI agents, where classified documents were allegedly found to have been in his possession. Stephen Chung, a senior communications advisor to Donald Trump, told Fox News Digital that the former president and his lawyers will continue to cooperate. The president and his counsel will continue to be transparent and cooperative, even in the face of highly weaponized and corrupt witch hunt from the Department of Justice. Hillary Clinton was allowed to delete and acid wash 33,000 emails after they were subpoenaed by Congress, yet absolutely nothing has happened to hold her accountable. The Department of Justice can go after President Trump they will surely come after any American who they disagree with. President Trump is the only one who stands in the way of the un-American weaponization of law enforcement, Chung said. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A top federal judge denied a request from the Justice Department to hold Donald Trump's office in contempt of court for failing to fully comply with a subpoena demanding the return of all documents bearing classified markings, according to sources familiar with the proceedings. The chief U.S. judge for the District of Columbia, Beryl Howell, told the department during a closed-door hearing on Friday 9th of December to resolve the matter with the Trump legal team itself because a contempt ruling would not hold, the sources said. The precise details about the hearing were not cleared with the case under seal, but the judge's move amounts to a victory for Donald Trump as he contends with a criminal investigation into unauthorized retention of national security information at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, and obstruction of justice. Federal prosecutors had sought to force Trump to name a custodian of records and certify under oath that all documents with classified markings had been returned to the government, as demanded by the grand jury subpoena issued last May, or otherwise find Trump's office in contempt of court. The contempt action is understood to be focused on Trump's political office because the subpoena sought to return all the documents and writings in the custody of Donald J. Trump and or the office of Donald J. Trump bearing classification markings. In response to the subpoena, Donald Trump's lawyer, Evan Corcoran, turned over a folder of documents to the Justice Department and asked another Trump lawyer, Christina Bobb, to sign a certification that she heavily caveated because she had not done the search, The Guardian previously reported. The letter ultimately said that Christina Bobb was making the attestation based on the information provided to me and to the best of my knowledge, a fact that she emphasized to the department around the time that prosecutors collected the folder and the certification letter, a person familiar with the matter has said. But after the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago on 8th of August this year, and the fact that the FBI found 103 documents marked classified, leading prosecutors to believe the subpoena had not been complied with, the department sought Donald Trump's lawyers to again certify that no further materials remained at Mar-a-Lago. The Trump legal team has resisted designating a custodian of records and providing a sworn statement despite repeated requests. The deeply frustrated prosecutors who told the legal team that if they did not provide a second attestation, they would seek judicial enforcement. Part of the Trump legal team's reluctance comes because neither they nor any other member of the former president's office have had custody of all documents marked classified and do not think they could comprehensively answer every question about them, the sources said. In a statement, a Trump spokesperson said the former president and his lawyers would continue to be transparent and cooperative even in the face of the highly weaponized and corrupt witch hunt from the Department of Justice. The closed-door court battle between the Justice Department and Donald Trump's lawyers comes after it emerged that a search of a storage unit in Florida holding boxes of material belonging to Donald Trump turned up two more documents marked classified, in addition to the 103 documents found at Mar-a-Lago by the FBI last August.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A group of Australian lawmakers arrived in Taiwan despite warnings from Beijing over the visit at a time of rising tensions over the self-ruled island.
There's a group of bipartisan members of the parliament from Australia currently visiting Taiwan. They are already here. We appreciate that the Australian parliament is very friendly to Taiwan.
Taipei's foreign ministry stated that the members of the delegation will meet the territory's president and other officials during their five-day visit. The ministry added the meetings will focus on a wide array of issues of mutual interest. The Chinese foreign ministry expressed opposition to the trip, calling on Canberra to respect the One China principle.
Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. The One China policy is a recognized norm of international relations, and it is also the prerequisite and political basis for China to develop friendly relations with other countries. The Australian side should earnestly abide by the One China policy, stop any form of official exchanges with the Taiwan region.
Under the One China policy, Beijing considers Taiwan a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland. The spokesperson also warned Australia against official exchanges with Taiwan, calling on Canberra to stop sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan. The visit to Taiwan comes as Australia's recently elected Labour government has moved to repair its strained diplomatic relations with China. Last month, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. But the parliamentary trip to Taiwan would cast a shadow on attempts to build ties between Beijing and Canberra. Albanese sought to play down the mission's significance after it was first reported. He insisted the visit was separate from government business, saying there have been backbench visits to Taiwan for a long time. Australia had long maintained it didn't have to choose between China and the U.S., but in recent years, its attitude toward Beijing has revealed where it stands in the world. Signing the AUKUS Security Pact with the U.S. and U.K., and rotational presence of American forces in Australia are a testament to Canberra taking the side of the U.S. over China. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will increase the rotational presence of its forces in Australia.
Today we agreed to deepen our defense cooperation in several important ways, including enhancing our force posture cooperation. And based upon today's talks, we will increase rotational presence of U.S. forces in Australia. That includes rotations of bomber task forces, fighters, and future rotations of U.S. Navy and U.S. Army capabilities.
The United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan.
What we want is a region that is stable, prosperous, and respectful of sovereignty. And as we've made clear many times, U.S. engagement in the Indo-Pacific makes an indispensable contribution to such a region.
The two allies made the announcement following annual high-level talks between the top U.S. and Australian defense and diplomatic officials. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Washington sees Canberra as a vital partner in its effort to push back against China in the Indo-Pacific, and analysts say Australia could have a crucial logistical role to play in the defense of Taiwan against any move by Beijing. Australia's Northern Territory is already host to frequent military collaborations with the United States. Thousands of U.S. Marines rotate through the territory annually for training and joint exercises, started under former President Barack Obama. The United States is also planning to deploy up to 6 nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to an airbase in northern Australia amid heightened tensions with China. Canberra has moved to bolster relations in the Pacific amid growing Chinese influence, including a security pact between China and Solomon Islands in April. In September, the United States, United Kingdom and Australia marked the one-year anniversary of the AUKUS security pact. They then announced that they have made significant progress towards Australia acquiring nuclear-powered submarines.
Israeli forces have shot dead 3 Palestinians during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank. According to eyewitness accounts, a large number of Israeli military forces stormed the camp on Thursday morning. The attack triggered violent confrontations with local residents, during which Palestinians were killed. The victims were identified by Palestinian media as Tariq al-Damj, Siddiqui Zakarne, and Atta Shibli. According to reports, before the confrontation broke out, Israeli snipers were positioned on the rooftops of buildings overlooking the camp. At least 10 people have also been injured there. Israeli forces also fired directly at an ambulance during the raid, and its medical staff reportedly survived death. Israeli forces have recently been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus. New groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed there. The latest figures bring up the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year to 216. At least 164 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Scores of Palestinians have also been killed in Israeli raids in the Gaza Strip.
Simply saying this, Israeli establishment, the military, the security apparatus, and the settlers have clear orders to kill. They kill Palestinians even in cases of suspicions. They are always quick to pull the trigger. Recently, almost all raids to the West Bank areas leave Palestinians either killed or injured, and none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes.
According to the United Nations, the number of Palestinians killed by Israel in the occupied West Bank this year is the highest in 16 years. Rights organizations say that Israel is conducting a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The rising violence against Palestinians comes against the backdrop of Israel's defiance to be held accountable for its crimes. The Qatar state-funded broadcaster Al Jazeera has filed a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera says it has new evidence showing that she was killed by Israeli forces.
Many have called for an investigation. Shireen's family who are here today have made their own request. The Palestinian Authority has provided a comprehensive body of evidence, and yet there's been complete silence from the Office of the Prosecutor on this case, on cases across the board, in fact, in the Palestine situation.
The veteran journalist was shot in the head, killed on May 11 while she was covering their raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. At the time of her killing, the 51-year-old journalist was wearing easily recognizable press attire. Al Jazeera now says its legal team has conducted a full and detailed investigation into the case and has unearthed new evidence based on several eyewitness accounts and video footage that clearly shows that Abu Akleh and her colleagues were directly fired in a deliberate killing by Israeli forces.
While there is overwhelming evidence from multiple eyewitnesses, over a dozen of investigations by reputable news outlets and human rights organizations and the United Nations, that Shireen was targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier, my family still doesn't know who the person is that shot that deadly bullet and who was involved in the chain of command that allowed them to kill my aunt.
It says the claim by Israeli authorities that the Palestinian journalist was killed by mistake in an exchange of fire is, quote, completely unfounded. Multiple investigations by independent organizations and media outlets have already concluded that Abu Akleh was deliberately shot by Israeli forces.
This was a proposal that was floated with only in recent hours, only today, by Al Jazeera. So I don't know that it has been a topic of discussion. I don't know that it would be a topic of discussion unless we had representations from the ICC that they were going to take an opinion one way or another.
Well, I mean, she was an American citizen.
Of course.
So it's not like you have no interest in it
at all.
But you oppose it.
We oppose it in this case for the reasons that we've discussed.
The Israeli military, following a long denial, finally admitted in September that Abu Akleh might have accidentally been killed by Israeli fire directed towards suspects identified as armed Palestinian gunmen. The United States has said it's investigating the case, but has refused to publicly condemn Israel for the killing.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the U.S. and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the U.S. move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support. The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not. Yeah. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said the country is building a more lethal force posture in the Indo-Pacific as part of efforts to make sure China doesn't dominate the region the way it intends to. Addressing the Reagan National Defense Forum, Austin said China is the only country with both the will and increasingly the power to reshape its region and the international order. He added that Washington will not let that happen. The Pentagon chief added that the next few years will set the terms of the U.S. competition with the People's Republic of China, saying Beijing will shape the future of security in Europe. Referring to the modernization of the country's military force, he said that the U.S. is aligning its budget as never before to China challenge.
We're aligning our budget as never before to the China challenge. We're making the department's largest investment ever in R&D. And forging stronger capabilities. And we're modernizing training and equipping the U.S. military contingencies in the Indo-Pacific.
He went on to say one of the meanings of deterrence is sea power, announcing that the Pentagon is investing in the new construction of 9 battle force ships and Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines. Last month, one of Washington's Ford-class nuclear-powered carriers made its first transit to Europe. Austin also noted that the Pentagon is concerned about Russia and remains committed to arming Ukraine while avoiding escalating that conflict into a U.S. war with Moscow. However, he said between the two nuclear power threats, China remains the greater risk. The Pentagon has also unveiled B-21 Raider, its first new strategic bomber in more than 30 years.
The B-21 Raider is the first strategic bomber in more than 3 decades. It is a testament to America's enduring advantages in ingenuity and innovation, and it's proof of the department's long-term commitment to building advanced capabilities that will fortify America's ability to deter aggression today and into the future.
The nuclear-capable Batwing plane is being designed to best the quickly growing cyber, space, and nuclear capabilities of Beijing. The bomber is part of a major nuclear triad overhaul underway that the Congressional Budget Office has estimated will cost $1.2 trillion through 2046. It includes the Raider serving as the backbone of the future airleg of the triad, but it also requires modernizing the nation's silo-launched nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles and its nuclear submarine fleet. The comments by Austin amount to a new warning shot to President Xi Jinping, even as the U.S. looks to establish what it calls guardrails and keep tension with China from spiraling out of control. The Pentagon released its annual report last week on China, which said the Asian nation has doubled its number of nuclear warheads in a fraction of time the U.S. expected it to. China could have roughly 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2038, which are far less than what the United States possesses right now. The U.S. maintained 5,550 nuclear warheads as of December 1st of this year. But U.S. military officials keep claiming that China will soon surpass Russia as the top nuclear threat to the United States, warning that the two nuclear powers have no mechanisms to avoid miscommunication. China has reportedly accelerated the expansion of its nuclear arsenal due to a change in the country's assessment of the threat posed by the U.S. The U.S. Defense Department has the largest discretionary budget of all the federal agencies, and it may receive up to $847 billion in the 2023 budget if Congress passes the current funding bill before this legislative session ends. In a recent meeting with its Chinese counterpart, Austin said he made it clear that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. On the other hand, China's defense minister said Taiwan is at the center of the country's core interests and is a red line the U.S. should not cross. He added that the issue has nothing to do with external forces and is for Chinese people to decide.
Washington and Beijing have held war games and traded jabs since a visit to Taiwan by the U.S. House Speaker in August. China claims Taiwan as part of its territory. It has harshly criticized Washington's ties with Taipei as interference in its internal affairs. The two Western and Eastern powerhouses currently disagree on just about every major issue, from human rights, Taiwan, the Ukraine war, North Korea, and the transfer of technology to the shape and naming of the map.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Ever since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's crown prince in 2017, the kingdom has been involved in numerous cases of human rights abuses. They include Riyadh's arresting and imprisoning of hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, critics, and other people for their political activism. The Saudi regime is showing zero tolerance for hearing the dissent voice, even in the face of international condemnation. The kingdom is trying to suppress these people in various ways, including spying on them using Israeli malware. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Associated Press news agency writes, an investigative report revealed that Saudi Arabia has stepped up its crackdown on dissent on the United States soil using an Israeli spyware. The report published on Wednesday, 2nd of November, found out that the Saudi kingdom had been monitoring dissent's communications using the military-grade Israeli software. Upon spotting instances of dissent, The kingdom would then resort to handing out heavy sentences and imprisoning the targeted individuals if they return home. The report says, according to the FBI human rights groups and 2 years of interviews with Saudis living abroad over the last 5 years, Saudi surveillance, intimidation and pursuit of Saudis on U.S. soil have intensified as the kingdom steps up repression under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This is by far not the first time that the kingdom has been found culpable of practicing the procedure which is known as transnational repression. The Associated Press report cites the instance of Abdullah bin Faisal Al Saud, a Saudi prince who is graduate student at Boston's Northeastern University. The Saudi royal was arrested and jailed on a trip back home after Saudi officials found out that he had been discussing Riyadh's imprisonment of his cousin, a fellow prince, with his relatives whilst in the United States. The report added, Abdullah bin Faisal Al Saud was imprisoned because of those calls. An initial 20-year sentence was hiked to 30 years in August. In the same month that Prince Abdullah's sentence was lengthened, Saudi Arabia gave a